Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. The guest speaker will be retired Omaha policeman Wally Jernigan, who spent 17 years in the Criminal Investigation Bureau, working in the burglary, robbery, sex, and homicide units. The topic of his talk will be the real cold case files. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 22, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kay Criss, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
I'm Kay Criss, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. Once a month, the club sponsors a noon forum and on an issue that we think of interest to our members and to the public at large. You do not have to be a member of the press club to attend, and we welcome the audience here today and our radio audience from KIOS. Well, many of us have seen television shows that deal with, well, criminal intent. There are the forensic-type shows, some with psychics or even mentalists, and there are the cold cases. Today, we have Wally Jernigan as our speaker. Mr. Jernigan has worn many hats in his career. Today, he's a member of the State Athletic Commission, but for 17 years, he was in the Omaha Police Department's Criminal Investigation Bureau, working in burglary, robbery, sex, and homicide units. He is going to tell us about Omaha's unsolved mysteries and murders, the real cold cases here in our city. Now, at your table, you'll find paper and a pencil. So if you have questions for Mr. Jernigan, please write them down, and they'll be brought to me to ask from the podium. Wally Jernigan, thank you.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. First of all, the spelling of my last name is Jernigan, for those of you who are going to be writing checks. And I didn't know that I was going to have to take a test. So make these questions easy, would you? It's nice to see some of the people that I used to associate with from the different news media outlets around Omaha. And as we've all done over the years, we've aged a little bit, but you can still pick out who they are when you think a little bit. But it's nice to see you, and it's nice to see everybody here today. I'm going to try and give you very briefly a few statistics, and bear with me. I'm not one to keep all this stuff that I'm not crazy about in my head, and I'm going to read a short thing that I put together here, and then we'll talk about a couple of cases, one that was solved and a couple that are unsolved, and then we'll get into some questions. If anybody's watching the clock, jerk the chain when it's time for me to quit. First of all, it's important that we all understand that a criminal investigator is a person who collects facts to accomplish a threefold aim, and that's to identify and locate the guilty party and to provide evidence of a person's guilt. Investigation is an art and not a science. Investigators, irregardless of which unit they're in, hate to end any investigative report with this last sentence: no further follow-up at this time. This case will be placed on open file until such time as additional information is received that could assist in the investigation. The fact that a crime remains unsolved is not indicative of a deficiency in either the investigator or the investigation at that particular time. If you think about it, since the beginning of time, there are cold cases. You know, there are a lot of people that they want to know who killed who and all that stuff, and we're never going to find out. The term cold case was coined and made the new buzzword for law enforcement by a popular television show with the same name. It is important that everyone understands that cold cases also apply to crimes against property, which include burglary, auto theft, destruction of property, and not exclusively to homicides or sexual assaults. However, we all know that unsolved homicides get the majority of play because those are the high-profile cases that everybody is interested in and draw the most attention. According to FBI statistics, criminal homicides climbed from 4,566 in 1963 to 14,811 in 2007, with the current clearance rate dropping steadily over the past four decades. The homicide clearance rate was about 80% in 1970, and I can remember that our clearance rate with the Omaha Police Division was always in the 90s, because we had a theory that we operated under. It was called gonads, and pardon my French, but it's get off your ass and go knock on doors. And we knocked on a lot of doors, and we solved a lot of crimes, and that's the way you do it. When you run out of things that you can send to the FBI lab and they can solve with a microwave in 28 minutes and three commercials, then you have to knock on doors. In cities with populations over 1 million, the 2007 clearance rate was just about 59%, down from 89% in 63. So if you think about that and you just drop it off at 60, if you have 20 homicides, you have eight left. Then the next year you have 20 more, and you have eight left. And you have 20 more, and you have eight left. So that doesn't seem like much when you talk about it the first year, but as you go along with time, the number grows significantly and becomes a political football that everybody's kicking around. A major contributing factor to the falling clearance rate is gangs and drugs. Indiscriminate drive-by shootings where the shooter and the victim don't know each other make it hard to either establish motive, opportunity, or means. Gang-related homicides are going unsolved at an increasingly alarming rate. And I would guess that the majority of law enforcement agencies throughout this country don't have what they would refer to as a cold case squad. Number one, it would be a manpower issue, and number two, it would be funding. However, there is a bright side to the funding issue. The National Institute of Justice has a grant program that they allocate money to law enforcement agencies for the specific purpose of working on cold cases. Nebraska State Patrol just got $226,000 to work on cold cases, specifically dealing with DNA evidence. So that kind of limits where you can go with it if you're using only the DNA evidence as your parameter. There are currently about 250 unsolved homicides classified as cold cases in Nebraska. If you think about it, it's not a big number, but if you take the population of Nebraska, it's a big number. However, we have law enforcement agencies like New York that they'll have 20 homicides a day, and you see the reports, and I saw some at a serial murder homicide seminar where it's marked R&R, read and reviewed, and they file them. If somebody's not standing there and hands them a gun and says, I did it, they don't even bother them. They just put R&R, see you later. When I was assigned in the sex assault unit, I worked with a sergeant by the name of Andy Davis. Andy was, if he got on your trail, you were in trouble because he was going to get you. Let's put it that way. And Andy had a way of putting things together a lot faster than a lot of people. He looked like a big kid that might have come off of a farm, but he was just an excellent, excellent investigator, policeman, and supervisor. Andy and I worked on a case that some of you will remember that happened at Cunningham Lake, off of 144th, I think that's the name of 144th and 4th Street, where a young nurse was sexually assaulted by a young white guy on a motorcycle. The investigation was conducted, and everything went cold. There was nothing. There was at that time DNA wasn't even thought about. A sex assault kit consisted of a of a comb and a plastic bag, and that was it. Anyway, the young girl was assaulted, and everything was done that should have been done. We ran down leads and ran out of things to do, and this happened in the early spring. And we went through the fall with nothing. The case was placed on open file. We went through the beginning of winter with nothing. And then just before spring, I had a little bit of a lull in my caseload, and I had talked with Andy and Lieutenant Serco and asked him if I could go out. And because the weather was starting to change and just spend some time around the lake, and maybe the guy would come back, because we had nothing else, so you have to kind of work up things to get it to work. So they agreed that at 1:30 afternoon I could go out there and stay till shift change and see if we could develop something. We were down to about the last two or three days, and the lieutenant said, "This has got to stop. You're wasting time. Nothing's going to happen. The guy's not coming back. It was a one-time deal. La-di-da-di-da," and on, and he said, I said, "Well, just give me a couple of days." He said, "Okay, you got till Friday." So I went out with my tail between my legs and went out to the lake and stood around for two more days. Well, on Friday, I got out there a little bit late. It was like 2:30, and the shift change was at 3:30, and that was the last hour of the last day. And I was sitting on the northwest corner of the lake in a little parking area up there that was overgrown with weeds, scanning the south side and the southeast corner of the lake with binoculars, and lo and behold, a motorcycle guy came riding down the trail. So I immediately called for Sergeant Davis, who was down around 72nd Street, and told me get out there right away, that I was on one side of the lake, he was on the other side, and we had to try to get the guy pinned in and find out what his deal was with riding a motorcycle on a trail in an area that is vehicles are prohibited. So I'm keeping an eye on him, and as Andy's now coming quite fast in an unmarked car, and I'm trying to get around to the other side, as I came down Fort Street, Andy's coming west on Fort Street, I went over a hill, and I saw the motorcycle heading east on Fort. There's a stop sign at 132nd there. The motorcycle kind of stopped, and we were almost there together, and something told him that we were the police. He took off, and the chase was on. We're in unmarked cars. We went east on Fort Street to 120th, across 120th to Maple, down Maple. Just before we went through Hefflinger Park, the neighborhoods all over with the cruisers with no red lights and sirens, and we're trying to get uniform out there to help us. Just before he got to the bridge that goes across Maple Street, he turned to the right and went down the embankment into the storm sewer ditch and headed south towards Dodge Street. So now we're both on Maple Street. So I copy Huey, go around. Andy goes the other way, and we think maybe he's going to come up either on Dodge or someplace. I get to Continental Bottling, the old Continental Bottling Company that was out there, and try to cut through their parking lot to get down to the storm ditch. There was a fence there, and as I'm trying to back up, an employee came out and asked if I was looking for a guy on a motorcycle. And I told him yes. He said the motorcycle's down by the storm sewer, and he went in the pipe. So I told Andy, and we tried to get around, and we got the motorcycle and couldn't find the guy that was riding it. The motorcycle is unregistered. The previous owner had given it to a guy for a car that was unregistered. So here we are. So we go back through all of the original registrations with the motorcycle and find someone who had registered at one time or another who told us that he had sold it to this guy, and then we tracked it up to a guy that says, "I gave it to this guy for a car." What's the guy's name? I don't know. So we asked him where the car was. He said it's in a junkyard in Wahoo. So we go to Wahoo, and there's a lot of junkyards in Wahoo. And there's a lot of old Chevys in the junkyards in Wahoo. So we're going through these things and getting as much information as we can so we can try to run down an owner And luckily, after about 2 days of that, we found an owner. We went to the owner, and he says, I sold it to that guy. Do you know where that guy lives? I most certainly do, because I went there and gave it to him. So he takes us to the address of the house. So we let him go. Next day, we go to this house, and as we pull up by the driveway, there's two kids working on an old junk car in the driveway. And as we pulled up and stopped, one of them got up out of the hood and went in the garage and in the house. And we asked him where his buddy went, and he's, I don't know, he went in the house. Or who lives here? He does. Got his name and all that stuff. So the mother comes out, and the mother wants to know immediately what we're doing on her property and this and that. So we tell her who we are and tell her what we need to do. We need to take young Johnny down to the police station and interview him about an incident that happened that he might have some information about. And so she goes and gets Johnny after about 10 minutes and brings him out, and we take possession of him. And she goes, wait a minute. All he's wearing is a T-shirt. It's got grease all over. She says, wait a minute. Let me get him a shirt to put on. So that greasy T-shirt, so it's fine. She comes out and gives him a shirt, and he puts it on. And I look at the report because I had remembered that there was a red, white, and blue plaid cotton long sleeve button-up shirt that he was wearing at the time of the assault. So we take him to the station, let him put his shirt on, and I'm grinning, and Andy doesn't know what I'm grinning about. We take him to the station, and I told Andy, I said, you interview him. And we got five or six policemen that were in the vice squad and doing some other things where they were in street clothes, and they had old shirts and what have you on, and made up a lineup. They were all basically same size, weight, hair color, and this and that. I contacted the lady, and I said, can you get down here right away to look at a lineup? She said, I most certainly can, and she was there within 15 minutes. So we're outside of the lineup room, and I'm telling her, you know, that we need you to look at everybody. We'll have them step forward, face in each direction. If you want them to say anything, we'll have them say something. If not, we won't have them say anything. But don't identify somebody just for the purpose of saying, that guy did it, and that guy's going to jail. So we turned on the lights. It lights up the holding room. And she goes, you know, you don't have to tell me anything else. And I'm thinking, oh, no, not in there. I said, what's the problem? She goes, the guy right there in a red, white, and blue plaid shirt, that's the guy that did it. And then she started telling what was in the report, and she identified him. And naturally, the rest is history. You put together all the forensic and stuff. And I think he's still wintering in Lincoln. But that was a case that was on open file. It had been forgotten about. The new buzzword would have been it was a cold case. We had to manufacture leads to get it to work, and then his mother helped us by bringing him a shirt. The first case that I worked on like that was a robbery and homicide down in an old grocery store down where St. Mary's and Jackson Street used to come to a point there. I know that some of the younger guys here will remember that old grocery store there. The proprietor there was robbed and killed by a young guy. And he'd gone home and was all in a panic and had the money, and the girlfriend swore that she'd never say anything. Well, this thing laid dormant for a couple of years. It just so happened that the boyfriend gets caught by his girlfriend with another girl with his baby. So now she's mad. She's going to get even. So she calls up the station and gets old Wally on the phone. She said, I'm going to tell you who's robbed that place and who killed that guy. And I'm thinking, who robbed what place and killed what guy? And I'd been in a homicide unit about 6 months. She said, that place downtown. And I said, oh, and so I'm going to act like I know what I'm talking about. I go, yeah. I said, yeah, tell me all about it. Well, it was so-and-so and so-and-so, and he did this, and he brought the gun home, and he threw it here, and he put it there, and we spent the money, and we bought this. So I said, let me get back to you. So I got Kenny Miller, who'd been around forever, and Kenny knew immediately what the case was. So we looked back and got the case out and pulled it, and there it was. And so we went and picked up Johnny Two Girlfriends and brought him down to the station and spent some time with him, and he eventually confessed and told us who was with him. And I think they're still wintering in Lincoln also. There's been a number of these cases like this, and one that how much time? One that I know there are a couple of people in here had asked a question about the Nevins case. Somebody had a question about the Nevins case, and over the years, and I was just talking to a couple of fellows back there that are retired from the police department also, and. Every once in a while, you'll get somebody who'll have a gun that they think is related to the case, and they still have the bullet at the station. And at one time, it was felt that maybe a minister, wasn't it a minister? Her minister might have done it, who immediately jumped up and moved to Minnesota. And that was when the question was originally raised. I kept thinking about this dinged poor girl from UNO who her father was on one side of the government, and I think she was from either India or Iran. Her father was on one side of the government, and another student's father was on the other side of the government. They ran into each other at the Bombay Bicycle Shop up on Dodge Street, and they kind of got mad at each other, and she slapped him, which I guess is a real bad thing for a female to slap a male in whatever country it was. Well, the next day, she was reported as missing, and a couple, 3 or 4 days later, we found her over in Council Bluffs in a ditch. But in the meantime, the kid that slapped her was gone. He was gone back to that case is still open, and we spent 2 or 3 weeks. We brought guys in from Uniform Field Bureau into the Bureau to work with us, and we went around and contacted every Iranian and Indian that we could determine was in Nebraska, and fingerprinted them and took hair samples and stuff, because there was some hair that was in the fold of a computer file that she had that was not hers, and which turned out to be nothing, because basically the suspect was gone. But an interesting note on that is we tried to get information on all students from immigration, and at that time we learned that immigration only tracks at that time, and I know now it's different, but at that time they only tracked students and people on student visas into the country to New York or San Francisco or wherever they landed first. And they could tell you that person got off of that plane on this day and we don't know where they're at. There was no tracking of the foreign students at that time. And I'm sure that that's all changed now, and you could probably find anybody you want now. They're probably listening to what I'm saying with some satellite or GPS or something. The case that I think about probably on a daily basis is Ricky Chaddick. And we all remember Ricky Chaddick. Ricky Chaddick was a young boy that was abducted on 42nd right off of Venton by the fire station up there. Across in front, his bicycle was left across the street in front of the bank, and I have some theories on why he was murdered, but I probably shouldn't expound on them right now because not knowing who might or might not be here. But Ricky's body was found on 168th Street off of State, and there was all kinds of stories that were going around that his body was carved up with satanic stuff and this and that. That is not true. That is not true. The child died of strangulation. And the fellow that found him was a farmer who was disking his field. We did about everything we could with that case and weren't getting anywhere. And we even had, I'm going to tell you, we even had an FBI agent that took a person who was supposedly a witness and talked him into believing that he could tell a forensic, the best forensic artist in the country, that from seeing the back of his head, he could do a drawing on what his face looked like. I think that that picture made every news outlet that there was. Redheaded guy with the long face and this and that with a ball cap on. So we had a couple of supervisors up there that were in love with the FBI. FBI could do no wrong. They had been to their academy. And that picture was the guy that did it. I was a primary case guy on the deal, and that's not the way the reports read. So I finally tried to get it through a sergeant's head that picture meant nothing to the investigation because he was making us spend unreasonable amounts of time chasing our tail on this thing. So I called the witness, and I said, "Would you please come down to the station?" I said, "I need to go over some things with you." So I had him, I didn't even take him in an interview room, which is small. I took him into the bomb room where we could have four or five people sitting around and listen to what I asked him. And I said, "Sir, did you see the face of the person in this blue pickup?" "No, I did not." I said, "So the FBI flies you from here to Texas, and you sit down with the forensic artist, and you put this face on that head." And he goes, "Well, they told me that I could." And so I said, "So you never saw the face. You saw the guy basically from just short of his right ear out to the right, towards the middle of the truck." "Yes, that's it." So that didn't play too well with the sergeant, who didn't like that. So 6 months later, I was transferred. But it didn't make a difference to me anyway, one way or the other. But that case went completely dormant. And the FBI, for some reason, got involved and kind of was put in a position of being in charge over that case. And this little agent about this tall with a jacket that was too long like this walked around, and he had the most weird theories on what happened. And it was his belief that we had to resolve that somebody in a bar in Omaha had heard the suspect mention that he committed this crime. So now we've got police from Uniform Fuel Bureau. Every unit was called in. FBI got all of their guys. Council Bluffs sent people. Lincoln sent people. Douglas County Sheriff. Pottawatomie County Sheriff. And they put us in pairs and split up to 700. And I think at that time there were 727 bars in Omaha. And they split them up, and we had to go into every bar and ask, "Did you ever hear anything about this?" Now, you know how dumb you feel doing that after about being told about the 20th time? Are you nuts? So, and we had a briefing every night, and after the body was found, they had called, and I was with Bob Amon at the time having lunch, and they said, "Get out to 168th Street. They found Ricky's body, or what we believe to be Ricky's body, and we need you to be there to kind of coordinate what's going on." So I got there, and and it looked like a wasp nest with all these FBI agents and people that I'd never seen before standing around, and they're all in. Now, you've got to remember that the edge of the road would be here, and then there's a flat surface, the shoulder that goes about as far as from me to K, or maybe a little bit further. Now it drops down about 15 to 20 feet, levels out, it goes another 20, 25 feet. There's a hedgerow with little trees in there. The body is found on the other side of the trees, and this FBI agent in charge tells me that the way the body got there was that the suspect came along in the car, stopped, jumped out, grabbed him, and threw him. And he landed on his back. It looked like he just went there and laid down. So I had trouble with that. And so we got everything done, got the scene processed, and sent the body to the morgue. And I had Eamon, I think it was Eamon, rode with the squad to the morgue and told him that Dr. Rothman was going to do the post, and to tell Rothman that I'd be there as soon as I could get somebody at the scene that would say, I'm in charge, I'll take over. So when I get to the morgue, there's more people in this little room at the morgue than is in this room right now. And Dr. Rothman says, Wally, you've got to get them out of here. I can't do my job. So we got them all to kind of move around, and some went out the door. And so we got that taken care of, and I had had enough. And so I went back to the station, and I told this FBI agent to bring me the results from Dr. Rothman. So we had a briefing at 8 in the morning and 9 or 10 at night, and went over what was done during the daytime every day. And so now this agent's going to talk about the autopsy. So he's telling what was done and this and that. And I said, are there any questions? I went, yeah. I said, you know, did they do a Woods light on the body? And he goes, a what? I said, a Woods light. A Woods light is an ultraviolet light that they check for semen or signs of sexual assault. I said, did they do that on the body? And he goes, I don't know. And so, using terms that I can't use here, I said, did they turn the lights out and turn on an ultraviolet light? He still doesn't know. So the case died from there after they brought in their psychological profiler, who had paper. I wish that all of you could see the size of the detective bureau on the fourth floor at the time. He had freezer paper that went around the walls, up, down, about as high as that picture where Leahy, around the walls, and had writing on it, and this and that, and could be this and could be that. So at our briefing that night, they're going to explain this psychological profile to us. First words were, it could have been committed by a male or a female. Good. This person might have been in the Air Force or the Navy or the Army or the Marines. That's good. He might have used a rope or might not have used a rope to strangle him. And it went on like that, and I'm sitting there, and I'm steaming. They fly this guy in from Washington, D.C. to give us a bunch of 50-50s. So I begged him to, and I even went to the chief at the time and tried to get him that we had a piece of rope from another deal, and to show that, see if anybody could say, well, that guy works where it is, and give us a lead on that. But it didn't work, and the FBI was in charge, and they finally eased out. I think that their whole idea was that they messed up the Johnny Gotch thing so bad that they'd come over here, Ricky would be found in 1 or 2 days, they'd get some positive press, and ride off into the sunset. It didn't happen. Next thing you know, this agent's gone back to Des Moines, this one's gone back to Kansas City, that one's gone, that one's gone, that one's gone. Now we're standing around, no more FBI agents. They're all gone. Well, the agent in charge wrote a book about the case. And if I could have got him and the book in the same place at the same time, I can tell you where that book would have went. But anyway, after a long, long period of time, we had nothing to go on. We tried everything we could. We worked a prostitute sting, didn't work. We worked some other things, didn't work. We had no place to go, and so we decided to take a young policeman and dress him up like a young boy and put him down in the corner of 17th and Jackson on Saturday night. That was Dutchenslager, Dutch. And he did look like a young kid. And so Lanny Linker and I were wearing uniforms that night so we could, if the guy had the contact, we could make the stop. And a blue Ford, tax-exempt Ford, went by where we were. Went by once and went down where he was and drove on around to come back by again. And I told Lanny, I said, we'll get that guy before the night's over. Lo and behold, we got the wire thing going, and we hear him making a deal. Excuse me. And Dutch tells him, pull up in front of the courthouse. There might be some policemen around here. Pull up in front of the courthouse. The guy pulls up in front of the courthouse. We pull in behind him. We're in uniform. And ask him for his driver's license and all that stuff. And he gives us a song and dance. He's trying to help the guy out and get him off the streets and this and that. So we let him go, wrote him a ticket and let him go. So the next morning, we went to the lieutenant and told him that we'd arrested one guy. But we had, the guy was working and living at the place that would give him access to Ricky and make things, make it not look good for him. Because he had told us he was in the area of 42nd and Venton, at a bridge thing that day. Everybody else went down to the Bohemian Cafe to eat. They did it every Sunday. And instead of going to the Bohemian Cafe, he went home to where he lives. But so that puts him in the area. So we went out to the school and had him get the guy for us. And he asked him if he recognized us. And he went, no. You know who we are? No. So we identified ourselves and reminded him of getting a ticket the night before. Talked to him a little bit and asked him if he'd take a polygraph, and he said he would. So for some reason, I'll never know why, I asked him if I could look in his room. Sure. So I go in his room, and laying on the dresser was the address of his mother. And I just copied it and stuck it in my pocket. I don't know why. I just did. But the arrangement was that he would be brought down to the station by his boss to take a polygraph at 1 o'clock. He would be there at 12:30. So we shot right in and discussed the case with Rich Circo, who was going to give the polygraph and bring him up to speed and tell him what we were looking at and what had happened. And 12:30 comes. Don't show. 1 o'clock comes, don't show. 2 o'clock comes, don't show. So I call out to his place of work and residence, and I ask where he was, and I was told he won't be back. And I'm thinking, well, maybe he's on the way down here. And I said, well, what about, and I asked for his boss. And he had to take him to the airport. I said, to the airport? Yeah, his mother was taken deathly ill, and he's flying home immediately to be with his mother. So I called the Michigan State Police, and I said, would you please go to this address and ring the doorbell and see if that lady is living or dying, and if she knows where her son is. So they did. She answers the door. They asked for the guy, and she said, oh, no, he's on his way to Albuquerque, New Mexico. to an institution where they put people that have sex and alcohol problems. And within about 20 minutes, I received a phone call from a young attorney who told me who he was and told me to stay away from that guy, to not make any more contact with the institution. And I told him where he could go because I was conducting a homicide investigation. And more, and to be more specific, it was involving a kid. So time went, and we tried to get access to him at this institution in Albuquerque. It was a locked-in community. We couldn't get access to him. Even with search warrants, we couldn't get to him. We had some court orders signed in Albuquerque. Couldn't get to him. So we waited and waited and waited, and just before I retired, we got word that he had moved off of the campus into an apartment. And so they were, you know, I call it the homicide shuffle, walk around with your hands in your pockets, kicking and stuff. What are we going to do now? They did that for about 6 months. And then they called me at home one day and said, would you come down and brief Jimmy Wilson and Tony Mohat? They're going to fly out to Albuquerque and see if they can get in contact with a guy and get him in and take a polygraph. So I did. And any of you that know Jimmy or knew Jimmy knew that Jimmy was on top of it. But they went out there and they got with the Albuquerque police, and so they decided to set on his apartment for a couple of days and see what the activity was. Well, in a couple of days, there was young boys going in and out like hot and cold running water. So they finally decided, we've had enough. So they went up, the Albuquerque police arrested him. They took him down to the police station. They set him up for a polygraph because naturally he didn't know anything about anything that was going on. And he flunked the polygraph. They also had someone else who was at the institute or institution take a polygraph, who also flunked the polygraph on the portion, do you know? And for whatever reason, that wasn't enough. So as we speak today, Ricky Chaddick's case is still an open file case and could be classified as what we now know as a cold case. But, and like I said, I think about it all the time. Well, number one, his grandfather was my sergeant when I was on the street and worked with him in the burglary unit. And I took care of him on 3 or 4 instances where he got in a little trouble when I was the president of the union. So I had a pretty good relationship with Bob, and I knew his kids. But we had to do some things in that investigation that I didn't feel were right. Number one is we had to bring the father home, who was in the Army, bring him home and tell him that his kid had been abducted and have him take a polygraph. You know, come on, we knew the guy was 700 miles away. The mother, they made her take a polygraph. All at the direction of the FBI. I had to go to Minnesota. Bob Chamberlain had retired, was living in Minnesota when this happened. I had to go to Minnesota with Rich Serco and Lanny Linker, and we had to interview Chamberlain like he was a suspect and have him take a polygraph in a motel room in Minnesota. So there's a lot of things that were done that took us away from what we should have been doing, on things that we should have been doing. So I'll kind of leave it at that, and I'm going to write a book one of these days, and I'm going to put the names of everybody in it, because statute of limitations has got to be over, and if you don't say anything that's not in a report at the police station, they can't get you for that, because it's all in the reports down there. But if anybody has any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them for you if I can.
There's been some cases, Wally, where private investigators have been hired by family members to help solve the cases of their loved ones, and I'm thinking of Dennis Whalen in particular. Why is it that sometimes these private investigators seem to have success in solving cases where the police sometimes don't?
Number one, we have to play by the rules. And before I retired, and I'm sure that before these gentlemen here retired, it came down to when you were preparing a case, when you were doing the investigation, you had to do the investigation almost to the point it was like you were making your pitch to the jury. I mean, it became that matter of fact. I mean, you couldn't just, there was nothing that was general. It had to be a specific and backed up by something. And it got down to where we had a bunch of detectives that could have probably wound up practicing law because we had to do everything according to the statutes. And the private investigators, they'd have to play by the rules. And sometimes some of the stuff that they came up with I would maybe question, but, you know, that was their business. They were getting paid good money. And when you can get the service for free. I heard somebody, there was mention of a psychic. We had a case. The little girl that was found down here in the sewer that was killed by the Hell's Angels. We had a psychic before her body was found. Yeah, Harmer. Before she was found, we had a psychic that used to call the station every once in a while and tell us where she was at and why she was there and all of that stuff. Well, one of the deals that she had was she was in a down in a manhole that led down to a sewage system out in the county on a dirt road on an old farm. So we took Ray Hunt with us. And Ray Hunt was the smaller of the guys, so who's better to go down the hole? Ray. So we wrapped old Ray up and sent him down that hole, and he got into a bee's nest. And he must have got stung about 100 times before we could get him out of that hole. And needless to say, she wasn't there. but we would get those calls occasionally, and we'd also get calls from people that were barricaded in their house with aluminum foil on the windows and tucked under the doors, and the Kennedys had helicopters flying above their house and trying to get them. And so you kind of had to sift the wheat from the chaff here a little bit.
If you had DNA evidence years ago like they do now, how much easier would it have been to solve some cases?
It would have been just as easy then as it is now. If you have a good DNA sample and you have a suspect and you can make the match, DNA turned the corner for law enforcement in a lot of areas. And you know, what could be better if you've got the facilities and the technical know-how and the money and all of that stuff to do that? But DNA is the thing.
This is kind of a two-part question here. What's the most difficult part of looking at old cases to determine the direction to go in solving it, and maybe about cooperation after so many years? Are people willing to revisit troubling experiences?
The majority of the time now, if an organization has a cold case squad that they call, they have people who sit down and read these things day in, day out. They go through the case, they'll make their notes, and they'll look at areas that were missed, things that should have been done, things that shouldn't have been done, areas that were explored but not good enough. They try to track down the witnesses who, in a lot of cases, have either moved or married. Their names have changed. People have lost track of them. And it becomes tough to find witnesses sometime. As a rule, a witness normally won't go bad. Because if they talk to you the first time, they'll talk to you again. But if they won't talk to you the first time, they're not going to talk to you again because they just don't want anything to do with it. But like with us, before these things, the cases that were unsolved, we kind of kept them in what we call the bomb room. And if somebody would call in, you go back and pull the book out and go through it and see what was going on. But to say that you sat down and went through a case and dissected it and tried to come up with a new avenue of approach, it wasn't done. I can't think of anybody that ever did it. You always had somewhere to go when you went there.
And is it becoming harder to get witnesses to give information? The reluctance to do so just within gangs or within other groups as well?
As I said earlier, the gang-related, drug and gang-related crimes are harder and harder to solve, especially the shootings where neither one knows each other. It's a random drive down the street because you're trying to get into a gang or whatever your motive is and shoot up a house and kill somebody in the house or shoot somebody in the back of the head and they're in a wheelchair the rest of their life. But gang-related crimes are hard to resolve for that very reason. The witnesses are afraid of them. And then you also have got to remember that we have some gangs here now that other gangs are afraid of them. We had a bunch of those Guatemalans that come in here, and everybody else was afraid of them because they didn't care. I mean, it was just another day with them.
What do you think of the Crime Stoppers program? Is it effective? Does anyone ever get paid for a critical tip?
I always thought the Crime Stoppers would be a good job to have, but then when you get all those phone calls and you got to run the stuff down, it didn't look that appealing to me. But no, I remember when George Ernst was up there, they paid out a lot of money for tips. And like it says, you don't have to give your name. The money's there, and if it turns out good, they'll pay you. Easy way to make a buck if you know something about a crime.
Or call me and I'll call you. I'm on fixed income.
Now, how did you spell that last name? Yeah. And our final question, do you watch any of the cold case investigations depicted on television? Are they good depictions of how it really happens?
I have trouble with the ghost standing at the end of the files. And, you know, you can solve them in 27 minutes with 33 minutes of commercials. It's a pretty good deal. You know, it's entertainment, and I suppose that that somewhere along the line that those cases are a part of a case that happened someplace that somebody picked out and wrote about or something. Joseph Wambaugh was a very successful writer who was a policeman in California. And he wrote about the killing fields and all those things. The key to his success as a writer was he wasn't in the field. He worked in the records bureau where he reviewed all the reports. How much easier can it get? We had a guy here for years that used to write stories for Master Detective and True Detective and all those magazines, Bill Bellotti. And I never could figure out where Bill got all of his information because he was pretty accurate on a lot of those things. So he had an end somewhere. And I always think that standing at the end of the files, he was there going through them. But I don't know. It's entertainment, you know. You can't get hung up on that. The one I like is the one where they stand at the desk like this and they'll say, yeah, we're going to do this. And it comes up on the screen. We're going to do that. And it comes up over here. And we're going to do that. And we're going to go here. And they've got about 30 pictures on this clear window with no wires at it, so I'm kind of trying to figure that out.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank everyone for their attendance today. We're adjourned. Thank you.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a talk by retired Omaha policeman Wally Jernigan. The topic of his presentation was The Real Cold Case Files. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 22nd, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, February 19th at 12 noon. At that time, the speaker will be Lee Simmons, soon-to-retire director of Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo. Among other things, he'll talk about the zoo's part in the decision to replace Rosenblatt Stadium with a downtown ballpark. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.